Chapter 3. We strolled into the town, but, though the night was excessively fine, and it was not yet 11 o'clock, the streets of the little capital were deserted, and the handsome blazing cafes round about the theaters contained no inmates. Ah, what a pretty sight is the Parisian boulevard on a night like this! How many pleasant hours has one passed in watching the lights, and the hum, and the stir, and the laughter of those happy, idle people! There was none of this gaiety here, nor was there a person to be found, except a skulking commissioner or two whose real name in French is that of a fish that is eaten with fennel sauce, and who offered to conduct us to certain curiosities in the town. What must we English not have done, that in every town in Europe we are to be fixed upon by scoundrels of this sort? And what a pretty reflection it is on our country, that such rascals find the means of living on us. Early the next morning we walked through a number of streets in the place, and saw certain sights. The park is very pretty, and all the buildings round about it have an air of neatness, almost of stateliness. The houses are tall, the streets spacious, and the roads extremely clean. In the park is a little theater, a cafe somewhat ruinous, a little palace for the king of this little kingdom, some smart public buildings with S.P.Q.B. emblazoned on them, at which pompous inscription one cannot help laughing, and other rows of houses somewhat resembling a little Rue de Rivoli. Whether from my own natural greatness and magnanimity, or from that handsome share of national conceit that every Englishman possesses, my impressions of this city are certainly anything but respectful. It has an absurd kind of Lilliput look with it. There are soldiers, just as in Paris, better dressed, and doing a vast deal of drumming and bustle, and yet, somehow, far from being frightened at them, I feel inclined to laugh in their faces. There are little ministers, who work at their little bureau, and to read the journals, how fierce they are! A great thundering Times could hardly talk more big. One reads about the rascally ministers, the miserable opposition, the designs of tyrants, the eyes of Europe, and see, just as one would in real journals. The Moniteur of Ghent belabors the Independent of Brussels. The Independent falls foul of the Lynx, and really it is difficult not to suppose sometimes that these worthy people are in earnest. And yet how happy were they sua si bona norant! Think what a comfort it would be to belong to a little state like this, not to abuse their privilege, but philosophically to use it. If I were a Belgian, I would not care one single fig about politics. I would not read thundering leading articles. I would not have an opinion. What's the use of an opinion here? Happy fellows! Do not the French, the English, and the Prussians spare them the trouble of thinking, and make all their opinions for them? Think of living in a country free, easy, respectable, wealthy, and with the nuisance of talking politics removed from out of it. All this might the Belgians have, and a part do they enjoy, but not the best part. No, these people will be brawling, and by the ears, and parties run as high here as at Stoke Podgers or Little Pedlington. These sentiments were elicited by the reading of a paper at the cafe in the park, where we sat under the trees for a while, and sipped our cool lemonade. Numbers of statues decorate the place, the very worst I ever saw. These cupids must have been erected in the time of the Dutch dynasty, as I judge from the immense posterior developments. Indeed, the arts of the country are very low. The statues here, and the lions before the Prince of Orange's palace, would disgrace almost the figurehead of a ship. Of course we paid our visit to this little lion of Brussels, the Prince's palace, I mean. The architecture of the building is admirably simple and firm, and you remark about it, and all other works here, a high finish indoors, woodworks, paintings, and see, that one does not see in France, where the buildings are often rather sketched than completed, and the artist seems to neglect the limbs, as it were, and extremities of his figures. The finish of this little place is exquisite. We went through some dozen of state rooms, paddling along over the slippery floors of inland woods in great slippers, without which we must have come to the ground. How did His Royal Highness the Prince of Orange manage when he lived here, and Her Imperial Highness the Princess, and their excellencies the chamberlains and the footmen? They must have been on their tails many times a day, that's certain, and must have cut queer figures. The ballroom is beautiful, all marble, and yet with a comfortable, cheerful look. The other apartments are not less agreeable, and the people looked with intense satisfaction at some great lapis lazuli tables, which the guide informed us were worth 4 millions, more or less, adding with a very knowing look that they were un pew plus churque lore. This speech has a tremendous effect on visitors, and when we met some of our steamboat companions in the park or elsewhere in so small a place as this one falls in with them a dozen times a day, have you seen the tables, was the general question. Prodigious tables are they, indeed. Fancy a table, my dear, a table 4 feet wide, a table with legs. Ye heavens, the mind can hardly picture to itself anything so beautiful and so tremendous. There are some good pictures in the palace too, but not so extraordinarily good as the guidebooks, and the guide would have us to think. The latter, like most men of his class, is an ignoramus, who showed us an Andrea del Sarto copy or original, and called it a Correggio, and made other blunders of a like nature. As is the case in England, you are hurried through the rooms without being allowed time to look at the pictures, and, consequently, to pronounce a satisfactory judgment on them. In the museum more time was granted me, and I spent some hours with pleasure there. It is an absurd little gallery, absurdly imitating the Louvre, with just such compartments and pillars as you see in the noble Paris gallery, only here the pillars and capitals are stucco, and white in place of marble and gold, and plaster of Paris busts of great Belgians are placed between the pillars. An artist of the country has made a picture containing them, and you will be ashamed of your ignorance when you hear many of their names. Old Tilly of Magdeburg figures in one corner, Rubens, the endless Rubens, stands in the midst. What a noble countenance it is, and what a manly, swaggering consciousness of power! The picture to see here is a portrait, by the great Peter Paul, of one of the governesses of the Netherlands. It is just the finest portrait that ever was seen. Only a half length, but such a majesty, such a force, such a splendor, such a simplicity about it. The woman is in a stiff black dress, with a ruff and a few pearls. A yellow curtain is behind her, the simplest arrangement that can be conceived. But this great man knew how to rise to his occasion. And no better proof can be shown of what a fine gentleman he was than this his homage to the Vice Queen. A common bungler would have painted her in her best clothes, with crown and scepter, just as our queen has been painted by, but comparisons are odious. Here stands this majestic woman in her everyday working dress of black satin, looking your hat off, as it were. Another portrait of the same personage hangs elsewhere in the gallery, and it is curious to observe the difference between the two, and see how a man of genius paints a portrait, and how a common limmer executes it. Many more pictures are there here by Rubens, or rather from Rubens' manufactory, odious and vulgar most of them are, fat Magdalens, coarse saints, vulgar virgins, with the scene painter's tricks far too evident upon the canvas. By the side of one of the most astonishing color pieces in the world, the Worshipping of the Magi, is a famous picture of Paul Veronese that cannot be too much admired. As Rubens sought in the first picture to dazzle and astonish by gorgeous variety, Paul in his seems to wish to get his effect by simplicity, and has produced the most noble harmony that can be conceived. Many more works are there that merit notice, a singularly clever, brilliant, and odious Jordans, for example, some curious costume pieces, one or two works by the Belgian Raffle, who was a very Belgian Raffle, indeed, and a long gallery of pictures of the very oldest school, that, doubtless, afford much pleasure to the amateurs of ancient art. I confess that I am inclined to believe in very little that existed before the time of Raffle. There is, for instance, The Prince of Orange's picture by Perugino, very pretty indeed, up to a certain point, but all the heads are repeated, all the drawing is bad and affected, and this very badness and affectation is what the so-called Catholic school is always anxious to imitate. Nothing can be more juvenile or paltry than the works of the native Belgians here exhibited. 10 crowns are suspended over many of them, showing that the pictures are prize compositions. And pretty things, indeed, they are. Have you ever read an Oxford prize poem? Well, these pictures are worse even than the Oxford poems, an awful assertion to make. In the matter of eating, dear sir, which is the next subject of the fine arts, a subject that, after many hours walking, attracts a gentleman very much, let me attempt to recall the transactions of this very day at the table d'hôte. 1 green pea soup, 2 boiled salmon, 3 mussels, 4 crimped skate, 5 roast meat, 6 patties, 7 melons, 8 carp, stewed with mushrooms and onions, 9 roast turkey, 10 cauliflower and butter, 11 fillets of venison peaks, with a saffatida sauce, 12 stewed calf's ear, 13 roast veal, 14 roast lamb, 15 stewed cherries, 16 rice pudding, 17 gruyere cheese, and about 24 cakes of different kinds. Except 5, 13 and 14, I give you my word I ate of all written down here, with 3 rolls of bread and 1 score of potatoes. What is the meaning of it? How is the stomach of man to be brought to desire and to receive all this quantity? Do not gastronomists complain of heaviness in London after eating a couple of mutton chops? Do not respectable gentlemen fall asleep in their armchairs? Are they fit for mental labor? Far from it. But look at the difference here. After dinner here one is as light as a gossamer. One walks with pleasure, reads with pleasure, writes with pleasure, nay, there is the supper bell going at 10 o'clock, and plenty of eaters too. Let Lord Mayors and Aldermen look to it, this fact of the extraordinary increase of appetite in Belgium, and, instead of steaming to Blackwall, come a little further to Antwerp. Of ancient architectures in the place, there is a fine old Porte de Halle, which has a tall, gloomy, Bastille look. A most magnificent town hall, that has been sketched 1,000 times, and opposite it, a building that I think, would be the very model for a conservative clubhouse in London. Oh! How charming it would be, to be a great painter, and give the character of the building, and the numberless groups round about it. The booths lighted up by the sun, the market women in their gowns of brilliant hue, each group having a character and telling its little story, the troops of men lolling in all sorts of admirable attitudes of ease round the great lamp. Half a dozen light blue dragoons are lounging about, and peeping over the artist as the drawing is made, and the sky is more bright and blue than one sees it in 100 years in London. The priests of the country are a remarkably well-fed and respectable race, without that scowling, hangdog look which one has remarked among reverend gentlemen in the neighboring country of France. Their reverences wear buckles to their shoes, light blue neckcloths, and huge three-cornered hats in good condition. Today, strolling by the cathedral, I heard the tinkling of a bell in the street, and beheld certain persons, male and female, suddenly plump down on their knees before a little procession that was passing. 2 men in black held a tawdry red canopy, a priest walked beneath it holding the sacrament covered with a cloth, and before him marched a couple of little altar boys in short white surplices, such as you see in Rubens, and holding lacquered lamps. A small train of street boys followed the procession, cap in hand, and the clergyman finally entered a hospital for old women, near the church, the canopy and the lamp bearers remaining without. It was a touching scene, and as I stayed to watch it, I could not but think of the poor old soul who was dying within, listening to the last words of prayer, led by the hand of the priest to the brink of the black fathomless grave. How bright the sun was shining without all the time, and how happy and careless everything around us looked. The Duke d'Arenberg has a picture gallery worthy of his princely house. It does not contain great pieces. pieces, but tidbits of pictures, such as Sudan aristocratic epicure. For such persons, a great huge canvas is too much. It is like sitting down alone to a roasted ox, and they do wisely, I think, to patronize small, high-flavored, delicate morceaux, such as the Duke has here. Among them may be mentioned, with special praise, a magnificent small Rembrandt, a Paul Potter of exceeding minuteness and beauty, an Ostade, which reminds one of Wilkie's early performances, and a Dussert quite as good as Ostade. There is a Bergam, much more unaffected than that artist's works generally are, and, what is more, precious in the eyes of many ladies as an object of art, there is, in one of the grand saloons, some needlework done by the Duke's own grandmother, which is looked at with awe by those admitted to see the palace. The chief curiosity, if not the chief ornament of a very elegant library, filled with vases and bronzes, is a marble head, supposed to be the original head of the Laocoon. It is, unquestionably, a finer head than that which at present figures upon the shoulders of the famous statue. The expression of woe is more manly and intense. In the group as we know it, the head of the principal figure has always seemed to me to be a grimace of grief, as are the two accompanying young gentlemen with their pretty attitudes, and their little silly, open-mouthed despondency. It has always had upon me the effect of a trick, that statue, and not of a piece of true art. It would look well in the vista of a garden. It is not august enough for a temple, with all its jerks and twirls, and polite convulsions. But who knows what susceptibilities such a confession may offend? Let us say no more about the Laocoon, nor its head, nor its tail. The Duke was offered its weight in gold, they say, for this head, and refused. It would be a shame to speak ill of such a treasure, but I have my opinion of the man who made the offer. In the matter of sculpture, almost all the Brussels churches are decorated with the most laborious wooden pulpits, which may be worth their weight in gold to, for what I know, including His Reverence preaching inside. At St. Gudule the preacher mounts into no less a place than the Garden of Eden, being supported by Adam and Eve, by sin and death, and numberless other animals. He walks up to his desk by a rustic railing of flowers, fruits, and vegetables, with wooden peacocks, parakeets, monkeys biting apples, and many more of the birds and beasts of the field. In another church the clergyman speaks from out a hermitage. In a third from a carved palm tree, which supports a set of oak clouds that form the canopy of the pulpit, and are, indeed, not much heavier in appearance than so many huge sponges. A priest, however tall or stout, must be lost in the midst of all these queer gimcracks. In order to be consistent, they ought to dress him up to, in some odd fantastical suit. I can fancy the cure of Newton preaching out of such a place, or the Rev. Sidney Smith, or that famous clergyman of the time of the League, who brought all Paris to laugh and listen to him. But let us not be too supercilious and ready to sneer. It is only bad taste. It may have been very true devotion which erected these strange edifices. 2. Ghent Bruges. Ghent. 1840. The Beguin Colleger village is one of the most extraordinary sights that all Europe can show. On the confines of the town of Ghent you come upon an old-fashioned brick gate that seems as if it were one of the city barriers. But, on passing it, one of the prettiest sights possible meets the eye. At the porter's lodge you see an old lady, in black and a white hood, occupied over her book. Before you is a red church with a tall roof and fantastical Dutch pinnacles, and all around it rows upon rows of small houses, the queerest, neatest, nicest that ever were seen. A doll's house is hardly smaller or prettier. Right and left, on each side of little alleys, these little mansions rise. They have a cordlet. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.